Scott Ritter served 12 years in the U.S. Marine Corps, specializing in intelligence. During the Gulf War, Major Ritter served under General Norman Schwarzkopf with the Marine Central Command in Saudi Arabia. In 1991, he joined the UN Special Commission in Iraq, or UNSCOM, as a weapons inspector. He took part in 52 missions, 14 of them as chief inspector. Mr. Ritter was confronted with both Iraqi obstruction and, in his opinion, insufficient support from both the U.S. and the Security Council. Finally, Ritter resigned, proclaiming that the illusion of arms control is more dangerous than no arms control. In 2000, he returned to Iraq to film a documentary, Shifting Sands, The Truth of UNSCOM and the Disarming of Iraq. The documentary captures the international community's reaction to U.S. policy while presenting a firm line on issues of international justice of states supporting terrorism, despite Saddam's known use of chemical weapons and his persecution of his own people. Is the war to protect our allies in the Middle East, including Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, and Israel? Is the war to restructure the Middle East, and in particular ensure that Iraqi oil will be under a friendly regime? And finally, is this war a last resort? Why must we now abandon diplomacy and launch a preventive, not preemptive, preventive attack? It is because of these questions and others you will get to ask that we have brought Scott Ritter. While Mr. Ritter may not claim to have the truth, we look forward to him having many answers, which will help us all find our own truths. Mr. Scott Ritter.
Thank you. Thank you very much, first of all, for coming out tonight to participate in what I view not so much as me delivering a monologue, as in we participating in a conversation, a discussion, a dialogue that can lead to, you know, a further development of knowledge and understanding about the very serious situation that we, the people of the United States of America, find ourselves in today. And so it comes to this 48-hour ultimatum. Saddam Hussein and his sons must leave Iraq, or else our nation finds itself plunged into mortal combat. 250,000 of our fellow citizens deployed overseas, brave men and women who do us honor by wearing our uniform, brave men and women who are prepared to give their lives in defense of our freedoms. And yet, we are torn. Because there are many in here in this room, and I count myself among you, who are against this war, who do not understand why we have to fight, who do not agree with the case that has been made so far by the Bush administration, and yet we hesitate now, at this moment of decision, to voice our opposition out of fear that somehow it would be interpreted as being disrespectful to those heroes who are there tonight, overseas, steeling themselves for combat, steeling themselves for the eventuality of death, whether it is death that comes to them or death delivered by them. In any eventuality, it is death. And I think we need to understand that before we proceed. What it is we're talking about here when we say war. War is not a video game. War is not entertainment. You may think it is, given the somewhat cavalier treatment that cable news has presented in terms of delivering the concept of war and conflict to the American people. Showdown with Saddam. Countdown Iraq. A line in the sand, as though this were the NFL, Major League Baseball, the WWF. Hulk Hogan, and I don't know, I don't watch this wrestling thing, but there's got to be something out there that, you know, but the thing is, it's not entertainment. War is actually the worst thing that mankind can do to mankind, because war is about death, war is about destruction, and that is it. Now, there are some in this room who are dyed-in-the-wool pacifists who say there is no excuse for war. War is never a solution. And I salute you for your thoughts. I salute you for your stands, and I disagree with you. I don't stand before you tonight as a pacifist. I stand before you as a warrior, somebody who proudly wore the uniform of the United States Marine Corps for 12 years, somebody who was willing to die for my country and then still willing to die for my country today. Somebody who took an oath to uphold and defend the Constitution of the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic. Somebody who believes that there is a cause worth fighting for, there is a cause worth dying for, and that cause is laid out in a piece of paper called the Constitution. I didn't join the Marine Corps to give my life for the President of the United States. I didn't join the Marine Corps to give my life for the White House, for the Pentagon, for Congress, for any person or institution. I joined the Marine Corps to defend a piece of paper that represents the values of this nation. We, the people of the United States of America, is how the Constitution begins. And then it sets forth the standards upon which we as a people must judge ourselves. The standards upon which we must perform to if we are to call ourselves Americans. So, ladies and gentlemen, understand that tonight 250,000 Americans, our fellow citizens who wear our uniform, who are there to defend us, are poised on the verge of war. And it will be hell. And they are prepared to die for you. What are you, as Americans, prepared to do for them? Do not believe for one second that it is unpatriotic to speak out against a policy if that is how you feel as an American, especially if you believe a policy deviates from the values set forth by the Constitution of the United States of America. You can be critical of a policy and not be unpatriotic. And right now, those 250,000 brave Americans need we, the people of the United States of America, to speak out in their defense. Is this a cause worth fighting for? The answer, only you can make that decision. But you need to make that decision through the process of democracy. This cannot be a decision that is imposed on you, that is dictated to you. This has to be the decision that you yourself have reached, armed with all the available information. A decision that has been subjected to the sanitizing effects of daylight, meaning that you can't hide behind a wall of secrecy. Data must be put on the table. You see, we live in a democracy. We call ourselves Americans. But a democracy doesn't work unless we, the people, are engaged, are involved. And a democracy will never function effectively unless the people who are involved are empowered with information and knowledge that comes from a fair and open debate, discussion, and dialogue about this issue. Is it unpatriotic to speak out against this war? Is it unpatriotic to ask a question? No. In fact, it is the most patriotic thing one can do at this point in time, because we need answers. No, we demand answers in order to empower ourselves with information so that we can make an informed judgment about whether or not this course of action is correct. Never forget that the President of the United States is employed by you. by we, the people. And to be critical of the president doesn't mean to be negative. Imagine yourself as an employer, and you've hired someone, and now you're putting them up with a review, a performance review. You can give them a positive critique. That's criticism. You can say, you're doing a good job. Or you can give them constructive criticism. You're doing okay, but you could do better on the following. Or you can give them negative criticism. You're failing across the board. It's criticism. And that's what an employer does to an employee to improve that employee's performance. The president works for us. We are his employer. Therefore, it is incumbent upon us to give him a job performance critique, especially if he's prepared to head us down a course on something as significant and serious as war. So here we are, as a nation, conflicted on the eve of war. And what do? Do we speak out if we're opposed to this war? Or do we stay silent because we feel to speak out would be against those who serve right now, who wear the uniform? Understand this. Every single one of those Americans out there today who put on that uniform to defend America, to defend the rule of laws, to defend the freedoms that we the people enjoy. If you're against this war, they want you to speak out. They want you to voice your opposition. I can say that as a Marine who's been to war for my country. I'm not here to fight and die to compel someone into silence if they disagree with a policy. You know, when I went to combat, I wore a flag on my shoulder, the American flag. And I love that flag. I pledge allegiance to that flag. And then I recognize that flag is merely a symbol. And that under freedom of speech, somebody may take that flag out into a courtyard and burn it. And I am fighting and dying for their right to do so. Now, I may be against them burning that flag, and I have to tell you that if I met them in a bar and we talked about it, we might go out back and have some personal words exchanged. But the bottom line is, when I put on the uniform, my personal feelings are cast aside. I put on the uniform, took an oath to defend America. So what I'm saying to you tonight is, don't feel conflicted about being afraid to speak out against this war if that's what you feel. Because the troops in the field don't want you to be silent. The troops in the field are fighting for your right to be an American, your right to express yourself, whether you are for or against the war. But the key thing they want you to know is that they are fighting for you. Now I come back to the original question. What are we going to do for them? How do we begin to empower ourselves about this issue of war and peace? It's too late to change the course of history. The die has been cast. We are going to war. I got the little Jimi Hendrix effect going on here. We are going to war. Is it a just war? I think that's the first thing we have to ask ourselves. Because this war isn't just going to finish with Iraq. This war is going to set in motion a course of events that will define how America interacts with the rest of the world for decades to come. If this is a bad war, if this is a bad decision, we the people need to be cognizant of this as soon as possible so that we can deviate from this course. If this is a good war, then we need to reinforce this action to propel the president in a course that's good for America. But the bottom line is, we have to get involved. We have to get empowered with information. Why are we going to war? The president tells us, sometimes, that it's about weapons of mass destruction. He says that Iraq possesses chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, and long-range ballistic missiles that threaten the security of the United States. The president also tells us that Iraq is a state sponsor of terror, a nation with links to Al-Qaeda, the terrorist organization that perpetrated the horrific events of 9/11, attacking the United States, and killing some 3,000 Americans in the span of less than 100 minutes. The president tells us that because of this link with terror, Saddam Hussein can provide these same terrorists to attack the United States with weapons of mass destruction, and that these terrorists, who are sworn enemies of America, will attack us again, but this time with weapons of mass destruction that'll make the events of September 11th pale in comparison. He says that this threat is there, it is real, and to do nothing is to commit suicide. That we have no choice if we are to continue to exist as a freedom-loving nation other than to preemptively strike those nests of anti-American weapons of mass destruction producing terrorist-supporting bastions that exist around the world. And the number one bastion of anti-American weapons of mass destruction producing terrorist-supporting people is Iraq. And we must strike. And we will strike. My problem with this is being an American, being somebody who respects the rule of law as set forth by the Constitution, I believe in a process known as due process, you see. If you're going to try and convict somebody, you have to indict them. You have to build a case. That case has to be based upon substantive evidence. And then you try them, convict them, and carry out the sentence. But what we have here is a Texas vigilante party. We're going to go out and string the guy up from the nearest tree because we think they're guilty. That's not justice. We, as a people, gave up on that 100 years ago. We don't have the posse ride out anymore. We have a court. We have lawyers. We hear a case. We make a disposition based upon the rule of law. And in this case, the rule of law is clear. International law as set forth by the United Nations Charter, of which we are signatories. Now, there'll be many out here who say, well, you know, America should never subordinate its national security to the United Nations, those blue hat wearing, limpy wristed, French speaking, you know. Why should we subordinate ourselves? We don't want the UN governing us. Well, that just shows a gross ignorance of what the United Nations is. First of all, understand this. The Constitution of the United States of America, which is the law of the land here, Article 6, states that when we sign a treaty or enter into an international agreement that has been ratified by 2/3 of the United States Senate, that is the law of the land. We are bound by that, legally. So never forget that we signed the United Nations Charter, that it was ratified, and we are bound by it. But don't fear. It's not as though world government's going to come in and start telling us, you know, that we have to convert from gallons to liters and Fahrenheit to centigrade. You see, on the big issues decided by the Security Council or by the United Nations, they're decided in the Security Council. 15 members, 10 of which are non-permanent, rotating. 5 are permanent members. We're one of those permanent members, the 5 big victors from World War II. And they have this thing called a veto. We all should be familiar with the veto because France just threatened to veto our resolution calling for war on Iraq. You see what happens there. The beauty of the veto. If you don't like the policy, you veto it and it doesn't happen. Hence, there's nothing the United Nations can do that's meaningful to the United States of America unless we want it to happen. The United Nations can't say we're going to vote to do X against the United States because if they do, we veto it. See, we're a member of this club, but we sort of are the member of this club. We're the most powerful member of the club. So don't be afraid of the United Nations. Respect the United Nations. Respect the fact that the United Nations represents a foundation and a framework of international law that holds this collective together, this global community together, and has successfully bound us together, not perfectly, but successfully, since the end of the Second World War. The United Nations Charter says some things, such as, we forswear war as a means of resolving disputes between nations. It says that regime removal is not an option, that no nation or group of nations has the right to pick the leadership of a sovereign state. That is the sole prerogative of the people of that state. It speaks of collective security. When it says it forswears war, it doesn't say that there will be no war, but it does say that in order to go to war, a couple conditions have to exist. One, you have to be attacked. Article 51 says you can defend yourself. If you are attacked, you're allowed to defend yourself. You can wage war in your defense. Two, collective security. If the Security Council finds that a situation exists that threatens international peace and security, it can pass a resolution authorizing, a resolution under Chapter 7 of the Charter, authorizing military force to be brought to bear by the membership to resolve this situation. Those are the conditions under which you can go to war. That's it, ladies and gentlemen. If you sign the United Nations Charter, that's what you committed to. And to deviate from that is to deviate from international law. To wage a war outside this framework is to wage a war of aggression. Now that's an important term, and I want every American to understand when I say war of aggression, it's not just simple semantics. Pull out the Nuremberg trial in 1946 and find out what the German generals and politicians were convicted of. The highest war crime is a war of aggression. To wage a war of aggression is to encompass all other crimes within the framework of that war of aggression. And if the United States goes to war against Iraq, void of Security Council approval, without recourse to citing Article 51, without recourse to saying we have permission under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter, we're no better than those German generals who invaded Poland in 1939. And that should be a deeply disturbing thought for everybody in this room. Now, the President has said that the United Nations has failed its responsibilities. He makes the case again about weapons of mass destruction. So let's talk about weapons of mass destruction for a while. First of all, let's state right off the bat that Iraq had these weapons. I'm not up here as an apologist for Saddam Hussein. That isn't going to happen. Saddam Hussein is a brutal, tyrannical dictator who has committed massive crimes against humanity, who has violated international law across the board. He has murdered his own people. He has invaded his neighbors. He's used chemical weapons against his own people, against his neighbors. He's fired ballistic missiles into civilian population areas. He's not a nice guy. He's the leader of a very bad regime, and the world would be a better place without him. There's no doubt about that. That's one of the reasons why the Security Council in 1991 found at the end of the Gulf War that his possession of weapons of mass destruction represented a clear and present risk to international peace and security. And under Chapter 7 of the United Nations Charter said he must be disarmed. These weapons must be done away with. And they created weapons inspectors to go into Iraq and oversee this process. I was one of these inspectors. And it was an important work. It was an important objective set forth by the Security Council. Disarmament, elimination of weapons of mass destruction. Now, prior to these weapons being outlawed, Iraq, when it invaded Kuwait in August of 1990, the international community stood up and they couldn't quite figure out how to respond at that time, so they contained Iraq by implementing economic sanctions. Now, this is an important fact here. We imposed sanctions, an absolute economic embargo on Iraq, as a means of compelling Iraq to comply with Security Council demands that they withdraw their troops from Kuwait. Iraq refused to do so. We went to war. I participated in that war. We liberated Kuwait. Should be end of story, except the Security Council then found that Iraq's possession of weapons of mass destruction still constituted a threat and said they must be disarmed. And while we were going to send inspectors in to disarm them, we continued the economic sanction program, this time linking it to Iraq's disarmament obligation. If and when Iraq disarmed and was found to be in compliance, sanctions would therefore be lifted. The game was up. Iraq would come back into the fold of the international community with Saddam Hussein still at the helm, but he would be disarmed. Therefore, he would not represent a threat. Ladies and gentlemen, that is international law. That is what the Security Council resolutions state in their Chapter 7 resolutions. That's what I went into Iraq to implement. Now, let's talk about weapons inspections. For inspections to work in Iraq, a couple things have to exist. A, Iraq has to cooperate with the inspectors. That's the bottom line. You can't disarm Iraq unless the Iraqis want to be disarmed. It's a big country. Inspectors can't find everything. And if the Iraqis choose to lie, to cheat, to conceal, you got a fundamental issue. Two, if you're going to pass a law requiring Iraq to disarm, you have to be willing to enforce that law. It's like any law. If I pass a law but then don't enforce it, what good is the law? If I don't know what the speed limit is out here, but where I come from, we got a 45-mile-an-hour speed limit on a road near my house. So if they pass the law, post the signs, have the cop out there with the radar gun, and people are zipping by at 75 miles an hour and the cops do nothing, what's that say about the 45-mile-an-hour speed limit? It's useless. So if you pass a law that says Iraq must be disarmed, and then Iraq cheats, lies, obstructs, and you don't enforce your law, what good is the law? What signal do you send to the Iraqis that it's okay to cheat, to lie, conceal, and obstruct? And I have to tell you, as a weapons inspector, neither of those conditions was met when I was a weapons inspector. Iraq was obligated to submit a declaration listing the totality of its holdings of weapons of mass destruction, all of its chemical weapons, biological weapons, nuclear weapons, long-range ballistic missiles, all the components thereof, means of production, list it all out there, lay it out there. And the inspectors are supposed to go in there and verify this declaration is complete and then supervise the destruction, removal, or rendering harmless of this material. It's a simple accountant's problem. Fact is, that's what early inspectors were. Scientific geek accountants who wore stylish blue baseball caps, nice UN armbands. They went in with a clipboard, pieces of paper, and their job was just to check things off. The problem is the Iraqis lied. They submitted a false declaration. Chemical weapons, they admitted having about 50% of what they really had. Biological weapons, what biological weapons? We don't have any, they said, so they didn't declare any. Nuclear weapons? No, peaceful nuclear program. What nuclear weapons? Ballistic missiles? Well, they can't deny that because they fired them. So, yeah, we got a few, but they held on to over 100. Iraq lied. They had no intention of telling the truth. So the weapons inspectors go in and they're confronted with this lie. But we didn't know they were lying because we didn't know what they had to begin with. They submit a declaration and we're suspicious. And suddenly intelligence comes in. June 1991, we get a satellite photograph from the United States that shows 100 trucks in a military facility on the outskirts of Baghdad with equipment on the back covered with tarps. And there's reason to believe that this equipment relates to weapons of mass destruction capability, so we send the inspectors out to this facility. They drive out and they surround it. Now, the Security Council resolution says inspectors can go anywhere, anytime. Instant access must be provided. That's the rule. That's the law. So the inspectors come into the facility, and they know they're in the right place because they look over the wall, and there they are. The truck's laid out with all the equipment. Inspectors knock on the door, expect the doors to be opened, as the law says it should be, and the doors don't open. Inspectors knock, and a guy comes out with a black beret, stylish green uniform, and an automatic weapon. And he says, "What do you want?" And they say, "Move aside, open the door. We're coming in to inspect." And he says, "No." And the inspectors say, "You can't say no. We have a resolution. It says we knock, you open. That's the law. Now let us in." The Iraqi said, "No, he has an automatic weapon. Tell me who wins that standoff." So the inspectors pick up the phone and call the diplomats in New York. They say, "How's the inspection going?" We're here at the site. "Great. Are the trucks there?" "Yep, they're over the wall." "Well, have you inspected them?" "No. Why not?" "They won't let us in." "What do you mean they won't let us in? We have a resolution. It says you knock, they open. They have to do it. It's the law. They're not letting us in." The diplomats were stunned. What do you do? Having not confronted this before, the diplomats sent the inspectors back to the hotel while they pick up the phone and called their Iraqi counterparts. Mr. Tariq Aziz, Deputy Prime Minister. He said, "It's all a big mistake. Don't worry about it. That poor soldier didn't get the word. You know how it is. Always somebody who doesn't get the word." Tomorrow, send your inspectors back out. Everything will be okay. So the next day, the inspectors go out, knock on the door. The door opens. It's great. The resolution works, but the trucks aren't there. They're gone. Finito. The inspectors say, where are the trucks here? I can say, what trucks? There were never any trucks here. There's tire tracks on the ground. We don't know who made those. No trucks. So the inspectors call back the diplomats and say, well, we're here. Great. Where are the trucks? No trucks. What do you mean no trucks? They're gone. The diplomats sent the inspectors back to the hotel. 2 days later, a new satellite photograph comes in. It shows the trucks are moved another 60 miles further to the east or to the west. There they are. The inspectors go out again. This time they surround the facility, put an inspector up a tower. He starts pulling out his camera to take pictures. The Iraqis take a couple shots at him. The inspector wisely comes down. But the Iraqis are nervous, so they start pouring the trucks out the back. The inspectors get in their vehicles. Two of the vehicles run up and go parallel to the convoy, taking pictures, close-up pictures of the material on the back of the trucks, until an Iraqi loads a machine gun, fires a burst across the front hood of the inspector's vehicle. The inspectors stop, but it's too late. They got the photographs, and the photographs show that the material on the back of the trucks was enrichment equipment used in an Iraqi nuclear weapons program. You know the one the Iraqis said they don't have? Well, ladies and gentlemen, what just happened here? The Iraqis lied. They submitted a false declaration. They actively worked to obstruct the work of the inspectors, to conceal, to threaten the inspectors. The law was broken. Now, what did the Security Council do? One would think that they would get together and say, the law is broken, enforcement time. And you know, that's a war I would have fought in. But they didn't do that. The Security Council got together and passed a new resolution that said, this time we're really serious. You have to cooperate, submit a new declaration, and don't shoot at our inspectors. They're going to go back in, and you have to be nice with them, play nicely, and cooperate with them. Not to tell you as an inspector, that's a horrible position to be in. Because we're there, hung out to dry. We don't have weapons. Our authority comes in the form of a blue United Nations identity card that says weapons inspector. We can go in Iraq and go to places and get cooperation because we're backed up with the force and the authority of the Security Council. But when the Security Council lets us down, we have no force and authority. The other thing is, and you hear a lot of talk today about this, the burden of proof was on Iraq to provide the weapons of mass destruction. The inspectors were purely accountants going in there to verify. It wasn't their job to seek. It was their job to simply account for. What happens when the Security Council catches the Iraqis red-handed, lying, cheating, concealing, and instead of holding Iraq accountable, sends the inspectors back in and tells the inspectors, you find the hidden weapons? The burden of proof just shifted from the Iraqis onto the back of the inspectors. And for 7 years, we inspectors carried this burden. It was our job to find the hidden weapons. It wasn't Iraq's job to declare them. You see, the Security Council didn't back up its law. Every time we found the Iraqis cheating, the Security Council passed another resolution and did nothing except send the inspectors back in. So it was an impossible position to be in from the beginning. But we tried. We worked hard. And you know, we were pretty successful. Inspections were an awesome thing to be a part of. You see, because after we realized the Iraqis were cheating, we changed the whole nature of the inspections. We stopped being pencil-neck geeks, and we started bringing in people who knew a couple things about intelligence. That's why I came in. Not that I'm an intelligent person. You can't be a Marine Corps intelligence officer. That's sort of a contradiction in terms. But I was an intelligence official. My job was to collect information and then to plan, integrate this into plans and go out and find these weapons. We brought in people who were experts in looking at computers. You know, a lot of information is hidden on computers. So we bring in these computer hackers who can go in there and take a look at a computer that's been unplugged, the hard drive's been wiped. They can boot it back up and reconstruct the hard drive. Those are nifty kind of guys to have. We have guys that can read Arabic because, you know, those computers are in Iraq and they speak Arabic in Iraq. So if you boot it up and you get screen up, that guy's had to turn to an interpreter and say, what's it saying here? The interpreter can read it, but he has no clue what it means because he's not a scientist, so we have chemists, biologists, nuclear physicists, and rocket scientists. Now, we're looking for documents, too. You know, some of the best guys in the world to look for documents are counter-terrorist specialists. know, because they go around the world and they do neat things like kick down the door, shoot guys three times center mass, and kill them. And after they kill them, they've got 5 minutes before everybody responds to this building. 5 minutes to look for hidden documents. And when people say hidden documents, they mean it. There's no bookshelf up there that says hidden documents right here. You can find them. These are documents that are hidden in ceilings, hidden under the beds. They're hidden. You've got 5 minutes to do a very good search of this facility. We go into a facility in Iraq. If we gain surprise, we got about 5 minutes before the Iraqis sanitize that place. So we got to bring in guys that we would call missile experts. But if you ever seen a missile expert, the neck's here, finishes here, thin little arms, pasty face complexion. The guys we called missile experts, necks began here, finished here. They had arms that came out here, and we said their qualification was that they could lift the missile. But these were guys that were experts at looking for hidden documents. You know, and some of these guys were German, French, Italian, Russian, English, Chinese, Japanese, American. They came from all over the world. And we brought them together and we made them inspectors. Now, some inspections were pretty simple things. How do you gain information? Talk to people. So we'd go talk to scientists. We'd sit them down, ask them questions. You know, and you hear a lot of talk today that debriefing a scientist in Iraq in full view of the Iraqi government is useless because they'll never say a thing. Gosh, we got them to sing like songbirds. You know, a lie is a lie is a lie. You can tell in Baghdad, you can tell in Cyprus, you can tell in New York City, but you tell a lie, I'm going to find out if I'm a trained interrogator. And the other thing is, if I'm going to ask a question, the guy's going to commit to a lie, I want the Iraqi government there, committing to it with him. So when I go to the scientist and I say, do you know anything about precision machine tools that are used to produce this part? And the scientist has never seen it before in my life. And I turn to the Iraqi government official that's behind him with the video camera and go, you concur? Oh, yes, Mr. Wu, we have never seen anything like that before. Great, I got it on film. Now, I leave Iraq, I go to Germany. I go to the Germans and I say, here's a name. Give me the list of visa applications in this name. Here's his photograph in case he uses an alias. Did he ever come here? Oh, yeah, 6 times. Where'd he go? He went to this place, what hotels did he stay in? Here. What phone calls did he make? Here's the phone book or the phone record. He called these factories. Let's go visit these factories. And we go pay him a visit. Hi, have you ever seen this man before? Yep, he came here. What do you want to buy? A precision machine tool to produce this part. You got a contract? Oh, we got lots of contracts. Here there are invoices, letters of credit. Gather up the documents. I go back to Iraq. I bring in the poor scientist. You know, the one who's afraid to leave because he's going to be intimidated. Hi, guy. How you doing? Remember that conversation we had about the machine tool? Oh, yes, Mr. Ritter. I remember it like yesterday. No machine tools, no parts. We have no reason for it. Good. Is that your signature on the document? Where'd you get that? None of your business. Is that your signature on the document? Yeah. It's an invoice. It says you received 12 of these machine tools. Yeah. It says, in fact, you received them at this airport. Yeah. Where are they? Oh, those machine tools. I thought you were talking about different ones. Well, these, yes, they're over here. Now we go. That's disarmament, ladies and gentlemen. That's how you disarm when the Iraqis don't want you to disarm. But disarmament is other things. We go to facilities that used to produce weapons of mass destruction and we do a technical survey of them. We go to facilities that the Iraqis say don't produce anything and we do a technical survey. We do no-notice inspections. Now, some people will tell you that no-notice inspections can't be done in Iraq, that the Iraqis have total control of the information. I say they're wrong. You know why? Because I would spend months traveling around the world, one-on-one, intelligence liaison with Israel, with the British, with the Americans, with the French, with the Germans, where I alone would gather the intelligence information, that I would sit down one-on-one with my boss and frame out the inspection. And then we would build the team. You know, we'd bring in the computer specialist, the linguist, the chemist, the biologist, and we'd bring them together and we'd train them in Bahrain, but we'd never tell them where we're going. We just say we're doing an inspection, a generic inspection. This is a room. This is how you inspect a room. This is a building. This is how you inspect a building. This is a facility. This is how you inspect a facility. Then I would take the team to Baghdad. I would meet the Iraqis that night and say, we're here with a team. And the Iraqis naively would say, well, where are you planning on going, Mr. Ritter? I'd say, it's not that easy, guys. Tomorrow morning at 7:30, meet me outside. We're going to be in a convoy of 14 vehicles. I hope you have at least 14 vehicles to follow us. And at 7:30, we depart our headquarters with 14 vehicles. Now, before I left the headquarters, I'd go to each vehicle, four-man team, each vehicle. I should say four-person team because we had some female inspectors who did a very good job, too. I don't want to come off as some sort of male chauvinist pig, although I am a former Marine. So, but we would hand out envelopes, sealed envelopes, to each vehicle. And they would unseal the envelope, and only at that time did they know where they were going. That's the first time they saw the target. And they weren't allowed to talk about it because we thought the Iraqis might bug the vehicle. They would pass the envelope around, read it, nod their head, seal the envelope back up, and off we would drive. Now, we're not going to make it too easy on the Iraqis because they got this vehicle out there with a big radio in the back, and as we drive around, they call off checkpoints. The inspection team's here, the inspection team here. So if you're plotting it, you can say the inspectors are heading in this direction. You can figure out the factory. So I'd split my team up into four separate convoys, and we'd go the four separate ways of the compass. Now the Iraqis are really confused because we're going everywhere. Not only that, we randomly just switch back and forth, crisscrossing around Baghdad. The Iraqis are insane. They don't know what we're up to, except I told the inspectors that we're going to converge on the site at 9 o'clock. So at 9 o'clock, we come in and surround the facility from four directions. Boom, 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 boom. The Iraqis are confused. At that same time, a helicopter comes screaming over, because I coordinate with two, and sets up a perimeter overhead, taking photographs of anything. While above, a U-2 aircraft appears, and there's a figure eight, taking photographs of the entire area. Meanwhile, I have another team sitting in a building with headphones on, spinning the dials, listening to Iraqi radio and telephone conversations to see how they respond. You think the Iraqis were in control of that operation? I think not. We were in control. We're the ones who dictated the pace of the inspection, and it worked. So, ladies and gentlemen, when I tell you that by 1996, despite of all the obstacles the Iraqi government put in front of us, we could account for 90 to 95% of their weapons of mass destruction, that is an accurate figure backed up with hard fact. 90 to 95%. That's not taking the Iraqi word at face value. That's taking the hard work of the inspectors. And that includes 100% of the factories used by Iraq to produce weapons of mass destruction, together with their associated production equipment. That is fundamental disarmament. Now, there will be some out there who will say, that 5 to 10% that's missing, we're a little concerned about that, Mr. Ritter, and I share your concern. Because among that 5 to 10% are things such as anthrax and VX nerve agent, things that, if you've been following the news lately, you'll hear the Bush administration saying a lot about. They have VX, they have anthrax, it's unaccounted for. Well, let's talk about that for a second. The Bush administration says there's 25,000 liters of anthrax unaccounted for. That's a lot of anthrax. Colin Powell reinforced this by holding up a little vial in his 5 February presentation. You know that white powder he had in the little vial? And he said one teaspoonful of this stuff could kill thousands of people. And he's right. One teaspoonful of that stuff. But the only people who make that stuff, the stuff that was used in October 2001 attack, is the United States of America. In fact, the anthrax that was used in that attack was produced by the Department of Defense. Colin Powell didn't tell you that. He made you believe that the Iraqis produced that. No. They produced this stuff. It's liquid. It's in a bottle. Not dry powder. Liquid bulk anthrax. Now, liquid bulk anthrax isn't really a weapon. You see, it can't become a weapon unless you can inhale it. So they have to be able to turn it into an aerosol. They never perfected that. They just produced the liquid bulk anthrax. Now, they put it in warheads, Scud warheads. We used to joke about them. The only way a Iraqi anthrax warhead was going to kill you is if it landed on your head. Because if it missed you, it was just going to put a hole in the ground. The sludge is going to pour out, and you'd look at it and go, huh. But the other thing about anthrax, liquid bulk, that you need to understand is that it has a shelf life of 3 years under ideal storage conditions. The last known batch of anthrax came off the Al-Hakam production facility in 1991. We monitored that facility from 1991 to 1996. Didn't find any anthrax being produced, but just to make sure, to drive the point home, we blew the factory up in 1996. All of it. Eradicated it. So when I hear the president say Iraq has 25,000 liters of anthrax, I'm wondering where the hell that anthrax came from. Because it didn't come from the Al-Hakam facility. For Iraq to have anthrax today, they would have had to reconstitute a biological weapons manufacturing base since 1998. And while it is possible that they did so, we have had weapons inspectors in Iraq getting full access, and they never detected any such production. Keep in mind the briefings that Donald Rumsfeld and the Department of Defense provided to the American people last fall, where all the photographs were put up on the wall. They said the Iraqis are rebuilding all these facilities, and we know, not we suspect, we know that these are being used to produce weapons of mass destruction. Well, inspectors have been to every single one of those facilities, and they didn't find a thing. What anthrax, Mr. President? What anthrax? And yet, no one asked that question. VX? President says that Iraq could have tons, hundreds of tons of VX nerve agent. But he doesn't tell us that the unaccounted for material, 85 to 90% of it, was used to produce VX that was produced on what they call the B route. Now, it's very technical. I'm not going to bore you with it, but there's an important thing about B route VX. You see, you produce it, and it's very dangerous. One drop, yes, will kill you. It has a shelf life of 1 to 8 days. Then it turns into sludge. Now, the Iraqis produced this VX. The last known production batch came off in 1991. How can it be viable today? It can't be viable today. What VX, Mr. President? What VX? And yet we're going to go to war because Iraq can't account for its anthrax and its VX. Yes, the Iraqis have an accounting problem, and it's their own fault. In 1991, instead of turning this over to the inspectors, they hid it. And then when the inspectors were hot on their trail, they unilaterally destroyed it without telling us. And then they finally were compelled to admit it when our investigators closed in on it. They said, yes, we had it. We said, well, where is it? They said, well, we destroyed it. We said, where? They said, over there. How much? We don't know. We put it all on the ground. Well, how can we prove that? Do you have any documents? We don't have any documents. So we went in, we did a core sample, we pulled it up, we said, yep, they destroyed VX here. There's no doubt about it. They destroyed an awful lot of it. But we can't tell you how much. So what we said is, because you lied to us, we're not going to accept any aspect of your declaration. So even though we knew that they destroyed some anthrax, we didn't give them any credit. And we said, you have to account for it all with documents. So we have an accounting problem, ladies and gentlemen, an accounting problem. But we do not have a clear and present threat to the national security of the United States of America, plain and simple. Ladies and gentlemen, we fundamentally disarmed Iraq by 1996, yet that wasn't good enough. Why? Because it's never been about disarmament, and I think we need to understand that right now. I want you to reflect on this. Economic sanctions were imposed on Iraq in 1990 when they invaded Kuwait, and they were continued in 1991, linked to Iraq's obligation to disarm. International law says that if and when Iraq is found to be compliant with its disarmament obligation, sanctions will be lifted. And yet since 1991, the stated policy of the United States of America has been the following. Even if Iraq cooperates in the field of disarmament, economic sanctions will never be lifted until which time Saddam Hussein is removed from power. Secretary of State James Baker, summer 1991. Secretary of State Madeleine Albright, spring 1997. That's the policy of the United States of America. You find me the Security Council resolution that backs this up. There is none. It is a unilateral policy. And this is the ultimate corrupting factor here. You see, if you're going to disarm Iraq, I talked about the two factors that have to be in place, two of the factors. Total Iraqi cooperation and the willingness to enforce law. But there's a third one, ladies and gentlemen. If you're going to hold Iraq accountable to the rule of law, you have to ensure that those who implement the rule of law likewise operate within the framework of the rule of law. It's the same concept of the police out on the street. Go catch the cop, or the crook. Cop, sometimes it's catch the cop, too, if they're a crook. But go catch the bad guys, Mr. Police Officer. But obey the law in doing so. Do not do an illegal search and seizure. Do not plant evidence. Do not break the law in enforcing the law. And when the United States has a policy of regime removal, it means that it finds weapons inspections useful only insofar as they facilitate regime removal. Weapons inspections and disarmament are inherently dangerous to a policy of regime removal, because if Iraq is ever found to be disarmed, you have to lift sanctions. And if you lift sanctions, you break containment. If you break containment, Saddam, Iraq comes back into the family of the international community with Saddam Hussein still in power, and that's the last thing people who support regime removal want. So understand, when the president says he wants Iraq disarmed, he doesn't want Iraq disarmed. not through the vehicle of international law. He wants Iraq disarmed through military occupation that results in regime removal. And that's why we don't have international support today. The world is united behind the concept of Iraqi disarmament, but they will not unite behind the concept of regime removal. And as a weapons inspector, we were plagued by this American policy. It destroyed the foundation of credibility that we needed to do our job. See, I was an intelligence officer. I was brought in to gather intelligence. In order to do that, you got to cooperate with the international community's intelligence communities. I mean, find me a United Nations phone book. I challenge you right now. Open it up and find the section that says United Nations Intelligence Service. You're not going to find one. It doesn't exist. In order to do intelligence work, you have to do it with the member states. And the biggest member state out there is the United States. So it's not bad that I turned to the CIA for assistance. I had to. It's not bad that I turned to Israel for assistance. I had to. It's not bad that I turned to the British, the French, or anybody else. They are member states. They are obligated to support our task of disarmament. A lot of people out there say you should never have gone to Israel, Mr. Ritter. The Israelis have this policy. There's no way you can trust the Israelis. Well, I'm here to tell you right now. I'm not defending Israeli policy. But in terms of the nations that provided intelligence support to the weapons inspectors, Israel provided more intelligence of value and was more honest in how they cooperate with the inspectors than any other nation. Because Israel bought in from the highest levels the concept of disarmament through inspections. When I started my work in Israel in 1994, Iraq was the number one threat to Israeli security. When I finished in 1998, it was the number six threat and falling. And the reason is that Israel understood, because of the intimate relationship they had with the inspectors, how effective weapons inspections were. Israel bought into the promise and the reality of disarmament through inspection in a way that the United States never did, because the United States didn't want disarmament. I worked with the CIA. I had a lot of CIA people on my teams, and they were on the surface facilitating disarmament. But how do you trust the CIA when the President of the United States signs a covert finding that authorizes the CIA to use whatever means necessary to eliminate Saddam Hussein from power? That's the President's order. So how am I to trust the CIA people who are on my team getting unique access to sites inside Iraq? What are they going to do with that data? They're going to come back off and hand it off to the CIA people responsible for eliminating Saddam Hussein. That corrupts the integrity of the operation. Ladies and gentlemen, you can't disarm Iraq so long as the United States maintains a policy of regime removal. And that's why when the President of the United States spoke to us the other night, he put his cards on the table, to borrow a phrase. He said, "We're going to war unless Saddam Hussein and his two sons leave." Is that disarmament or is that regime removal? What are we going to war for? It certainly isn't weapons of mass destruction. And here's another thing that should bother everybody here. We've been told that there is this proof, this absolute proof and evidence that the United States has in regards to Iraq's possession. In fact, as last fall, the President said, "I have this smoking gun, but I can't share it with you because it's so sensitive. It's really secret." That's okay, Mr. President. I accept that because I've read the Constitution. I understand that you may be in possession of information that can't be shared to the general public. But the Constitution requires you to share it with the appropriate congressional oversight committees. That's why we have a Senate Select Committee on Intelligence and a House Oversight Committee. Now, I'll just give you a case in point here. Senator Dianne Feinstein of the state of California. Staunch anti-war activist. She said no way she was going to support a war on Iraq. No way at all. Until the eve of the historical vote in the Congress to give the President war powers authority. And suddenly she's on the Senate Intelligence Committee. Suddenly there's a briefing, top secret briefing behind closed doors, and evidence is shown. And Feinstein comes out and says, "I have seen compelling evidence that has changed my mind. That is why I have no choice but to vote in favor of the war." Well, what was this compelling evidence? Well, the hint of it at the time when the Bush administration spoke of proof that Iraq was seeking to acquire uranium from an African country. That was the evidence provided to Senator Feinstein. Compelling evidence. Documents. We now know those documents were forgeries. The CIA presented Senator Dianne Feinstein with forged documents. And they knew it. They lied to a senator on an intelligence committee responsible for oversight, and it changed her vote. How many other votes were so changed? Ladies and gentlemen, we're going to war based upon a lie. A lie. There simply are no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. No one has made the case for these weapons. Therefore, I don't want to hear the president say that 250,000 Americans are prepared to give their lives to defend me from a threat that doesn't exist. So what do we do? What do we do? We're going to war. The answer is simple. We behave as Americans. Now, you're going to have to decide what that means. That's an individual responsibility. I can't tell you what the answer is. You're going to have to reach down deep inside and decide, are you a good American? Are you a citizen? There's a question I have for you. Are you a citizen of the United States of America? I know a lot of you are going to say, of course I am. I was born here. I'm a naturalized citizen. No. That doesn't make you a citizen. That makes you a consumer. That makes you somebody... That makes you somebody like the rest of us who have wrapped themselves in a cocoon of comfort and we're so happy with our current standard of living that we allow the government to waddle us along in any direction they want, and as long as they don't rock the boat too much, you can do what you want, Mr. President. Go to war? Okay, go to war. Just don't rock my boat. Well, that's not being a citizen. A citizen is somebody who invests themselves into American democracy, sweat equity, intellectual equity. A citizen is somebody who participates. And I have to tell you right now, America is failing across the board on the citizenship quotient. Just take a look at the low percentage of Americans who actually participate in the electoral process. We can't call ourselves a democracy if we can only put 37% of the people out on the election polls on election day. A citizen is somebody who demands answers. A citizen is somebody who understands that when we say the government of the United States, we don't look at Washington, D.C., we look in the mirror, who understands what we the people means. A citizen is somebody who will hold accountable those elected representatives who do things in our name. That is a citizen. We have 250,000 Americans prepared to give their lives right now in the deserts of Iraq. They're doing it in defense of the Constitution, in defense of America, in defense of we the people. It is not unpatriotic, therefore, for we the people to behave as citizens, to invest ourselves in this great thing we call American democracy, to hold our elected officials accountable for what they do in our name. Those brave Americans out there would demand nothing less. Thank you very much, and I'll take any questions anybody has.
We're going to...